Hello, my name is Lisa Lowe, and I am an alcoholic. And there is a certain kind of crazy in this room that's making me feel so much at home. The man running around in a red dress. I'm like, oh, Uncle Mike. He was in my family. I know him. Oh, my goodness. Between the Red Bull and the sobriety countdown, I'm like, woo! Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Debbie, so much for picking me up at the airport. Thank you, thank you, thank you, because that airport is scary. It's a big airport. It's really scary. Debbie, we just chatted about all of the things that we had in common, our vacations and our travels, and we laughed and giggled, and it was really a beautiful ride in. And Amy for asking me to come to Georgia, and what an honor it is. You know, I was sitting there, we were doing the countdown, and they were looking at my face. They're like, oh, you haven't been to a countdown? I said, not like this. And Anne-Marie said to me, you know, this is, well, we talk the language of the heart, and we're in the heart of Georgia, and our language is love. And I almost started crying right there and then. I thought, oh, my God, what a beautiful thing to say. And for Jocelyn for hosting me. I mean, we got to go and get hairspray, talk about girl things, and also we got to talk about what it's like to be a woman in sobriety and how being a woman has affected our sobriety and what we needed to learn and all the good stuff over a Chick-fil-A lemon frosty, right? It's so nice to connect with people on such a level of, you know, heart to heart. Like, you can't find that out there. I don't know about anybody else, but I've never been able to meet a stranger and tell them all about myself from heart to heart without judgment that I just met 3 hours ago. Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion, is the largest spiritual movement of the 20th century. It really is. And not only do we get a seat, there's so many that don't get a seat, but it's for a dollar in the basket. And all we ask you to do is if you don't have it, don't steal it. Well, that's what they do up north. Here, I'm sure it's a lot nicer. I am a Yankee, so I have to watch myself. I'm going to be going up north going, bless his heart. Bless his heart. I learned that one down here. It's great. So I'm going to tell you, for Lee. Lee, thank you so much. Lee, when I came in, he's like, are you ready to pray, girl? I said, yes, I am. We went out and we prayed, and he just had such a beautiful prayer for me. And, you know, and for all the speakers, right? I was in the hospitality, and I was talking to a couple, and they were like, you know, whoever did the speakers this year, really, they're so diversified. Like, you know, from Billy being like this Irish cop guy, you know, and then, you know, just, you know, it was just incredible. Chris and his passion about really spreading the message of what the book says, right, and not our opinions. And we all come from different places and different backgrounds, and you know, it's just been beautiful. And I've gotten a different perspective when I heard Bev with the Al-Anon, and I don't know, it's just been a really good conference, and I'm really blessed to be a part of it. So thank you so much for allowing me to come up here and speak in front of you tonight. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And so I'm an Irish Catholic kid. I don't know if Billy had, I think he left, but I really related to his story. And he said, you know, you don't have to be Irish to be an alcoholic, but I don't know, my family, woo, we used to call ourselves the CIA, right? Catholic Irish Alcoholic, right? Because, you know, in the CIA, you keep everything hush, right? We don't talk about what happens outside the doors. And my life, I'm raised in Philadelphia. I was born and raised in Philadelphia. And I was born into a family with four older brothers, okay, my dad. So I had five men that raised me and my mom. And I was the only female child and the youngest. And like I just was raised in booze. I don't know how else to put it like that, but all of my brothers drank, my father drank. My mother was the only one who didn't drink. And she was an untreated Al-Anon person. And I see her in a completely different way now than I used to see her. But she was like the outcast because all of us drank. We were all like, you know, we had this unity. And my poor mother, like, you know, she had married an alcoholic that she didn't know that she married an alcoholic at the time and then proceeded to have five children with that alcoholic, and four of them out of five were alcoholic. She, my mother had a rough life. But I never seen it like that, right? She was always like the enemy, right? Like she was always telling us what to do and how to do it and where to do it. And I see that completely different today due to Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyway, I was 9 years old when my first encounter with alcoholism, my Uncle Frank had died. And I'll never forget, we went to the funeral. Now, if you're an Irish kid, right, where they have they have wakes, right, and it's usually open casket, right? And my mother was taking me, you know, to pay respect to my Uncle Frank. And he was a young man. He died of cancer when he was 47. And there was a line, you know, all the way down Burns Funeral Home. But my father and my Uncle Mike were handing out silo cups, right, because there was a half a keg of beer out of the Pontiac Skylark that they had. And as you walked into the funeral home, my dad and my Uncle Mike were handing out half of beers. And if you've ever been into an Irish funeral, it mimics an Irish wedding. And just there's a little bit more tears in between. So I went up to pay respect to my Uncle Frank, and I remember my mother being very uneasy with all of this. And in my house, it was sort of like, now I'm completely Irish, right? And it was sort of like my mom was Grace Kelly, who married Jimmy Hoffa. Okay? That's how it was. And so my mother came one side of the Irish fence and my father from a different side. So when we went up to pay homage, to pay respect to my Uncle Frank, all around his coffin was like Taylor Mardu and Seagram's and, you know, all of these whiskeys, all these bottles of whiskey. And I remember my mother leaning down and saying, not all funerals are like this, Lisa. You know, and I remember thinking, I didn't even know what the hell she was talking about it, but I knew that she wanted to get me the hell out of there. You know, that's the Irish. They want to send you off with all the booze that you can handle in the afterlife, right? So I was 9 years old. By the time I was 11, I picked up my first drink, and I was a blackout drinker from the gate. And I really like what Chris had to say last night, because in my opinion, and this is just my experience, right, everybody has their own experience of what happened and what it's like now and what happened in between. And he was talking about how alcoholism does not manifest in bottles. It manifests in people. And the moment that I ingested alcohol, it was like Chia Pet. Like I was instant alcoholic. Blackout drinker from the gate. I was 11 years old. And I wanted to be like my brothers, and they all drank like that. So I wanted to be just like them. And, you know, I did. And in the beginning, maybe for 4 or 5 years, there was no consequences. It was all fun and a lot of laughing and a lot of hanging out with my brother's friends and just a ball. But when I got to be about 17 and I'm drinking before I go into my senior year of high school, I suspect something's wrong, but I'm not really interested. So I keep drinking and I keep drinking and I keep drinking. And, you know, there's a difference between denial and delusion. Okay? Denial is like something that's like here, like on your ears, right? And you kind of suspect that it's there. And then like every time you turn your head, it turns with you. So you know that it's there, but you're not exactly sure with it. Well, delusion, Delusion is when you can put me on a lie detector test and I pass with flying colors. And I don't even know that I'm in delusion and illusion. I believe. That's alcoholism to me. That is my experience with alcoholism. I wasn't in denial. I was deluded. And, we all have our own experiences of what alcohol had done to us. And I could go on and on and on about the hospitals, the institutions, the car wrecks that I was in. I mean, I have plenty of that, plenty of it. I mean, I'll tell you one particular case. So one story, so you know that I qualify up here, is that I was in a car and I was drinking a lot, and I had this habit of drinking and driving. And I picked up some guy at a bar, and we got into a car accident, and I slammed into an oak tree. And, of course, he was married with 3 children, of course. And I had broken the half of my left side of my body. I broke my femur in 2 places and my ribs and my, all the way up my left side of my body. And the ambulance came. And they took me out, and I went to Frankfurt Tarsdale Hospital, and I'm laying in there, and an orthopedic surgeon came in and, took my blood alcohol level. It was like 3.4, and they had to wait to operate on me because I was so drunk. And, I was in a coma for 4 days. They had to induce a coma, blah, blah, blah. You know the deal, right? And just the moment I woke up out of that coma, the first thing I said to my family was, I wasn't driving. The first thing, not hello, how you doing? I was like, I wasn't driving, because there's no way I could have taken responsibility for that. I went home, and my mom and dad let me live in their basement. In Philadelphia, they got row homes with these things called basements, right? So they put me in the basement because they were scared of death of fire. So I'm in the basement, and I'm starting to recover, and they take the hard cast off. They put that Velcro thing in with the big waist thing. That thing. I don't know if you guys have ever been in that thing, but now I'm walking around in crutches and in a walker, and I get a bright idea. You ever have one of those? And I called my girlfriend Janet, and I'm like, Jan, listen, why don't you come down and, we'll go out to the AD club. I bet you 10-1 I can get a lot of free drinks on this leg. She's like, you're brilliant. These are the kind of people I hung out with, right? She was as bad as I. So anyway, she comes out, we go out, and of course I had a boyfriend at the time who was, hunting me down. You know how they hunt us down, they find us. And he went into the, and here I am on the dance floor, right, with my walker, This is a true story. And he walks up, he's like, get in the goddamn car. You know how they are. And I was like, you don't understand me. So anyway, we get in the car. And as we get in the car, we're going down 95. And I get another bright idea, but this idea was a little bit more vicious. And I had the idea of he needs to be taught a lesson. He needs to be taught a lesson, trying to chase me down and ruin my fun. Remember that? They're ruining my fun. And I just took his steering wheel and 60 miles an hour went into a guardrail. And thank God that the only person that got hurt was me. And I had a hairline fracture in my tibia and fibula in my right leg. Now, this is a true story, okay? So, like 6 months, I had 2 broken legs, and I think I'm okay. That's not denial, people. That's delusion, okay? And what's even crazier is that this is a true story. This same ambulance came and got me. And the same orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Evelyn Wicken, was on call, and she took one look at me and said, put her on the side. We're not doing anything until she sobers up. And I was in, agony. And there I was at Frankfurt Tarsdale again. Do you think that stopped me? Not even a little bit. Because it was the ice when I was making the turn, and I was only doing it, all of that stuff, that I convinced myself that I really didn't do that. Like, I was drunk enough where I really didn't do that. So that's one story. One story out of 14 years of drinking. My sobriety date is June the 15th, 1993. So thank you for clapping, but I just want to let you know I got sober at 4. But, I got sober when I was 27. So my drinking was like horrific. By the time I was 27, I looked like an old woman. My hair was three different, I was a mess. And by the way, I didn't have treatment or any of that kind of stuff. I was what they called struck sober, but I'll get to that in a minute. Anyway, I have story after story after story about all the car accidents, all the broken hearts, all the crying, all the. But I have to tell you that I didn't care. I don't know. I did not have that where when you hear other speakers talk about like I was so remorseful and I knew it was over. It wasn't that way for me. Okay. I was so delusional that in the end of my drinking, I was homeless. I was living in the woods. I had nowhere else to go. But I'm going to back up about 6 months before that happened. I was still couch surfing. Has anybody done that in here? A little couch surfing? Oh, yeah. Oh, a couple hands in the back. Right? Where you start going to your girlfriend's houses, and then, you know, their boyfriends or their husbands start giving you the evil eye of, like, you got to go. You know that eye of, like, you have outstayed your welcome. Right? And that's what was happening to me, is I had nowhere else to go, and the couch surfing now, it's not working. So one time, I don't know exactly where I was, but I was completely hammered, and I was waiting for a place called the City Line Bar to open up right by the 66 bus to Frankfurt Avenue in Philadelphia, if you're familiar with that. And this is the kind of bar where they have bars on the window, you know, the real kind, you know, right? And I was slumped up against the wall, and there was a gentleman there, and his name was Joe Brown. And he had a Philadelphia Inquirer stand right there, like maybe 20 feet away. And I'm slumped up on the side, right? And I have like 3 fingernails, and I had stockings on at the time, and mini skirt that was a little high, if you know what I mean. And I'm slumped over, and I'm drunk, and he comes out of the Philadelphia Inquirer stand, and he says, "Hey, how you doing? You know, my name's Joe." And I was like, oh, he wants me. You know how we are when we're out there, right? Well, we look like this, and we're like, we're gorgeous. We think we're gorgeous. Like, we haven't bathed in 3 days, and we're like, I'm so delusional, not denial. So, anyway, so he started to talk to me about my drinking. That made me very uncomfortable. And I was like, oh, he wants something. You know, he's going to rape me. Right? So I go running off, and I'm trying to get back to, you know, my girlfriend's couches, but I'm no longer welcome there. So now I have this bright idea where I start sleeping in the woods. So, and the idea was this, that if I could just live in the woods, right, and then I would wait, you know, in Philadelphia, they had what they call basement sliding glass doors, if anybody knows about them, and if you jiggle them, you know, quite right, and I had 4 older brothers, so, you know, I know how to jiggle things, and I would, you know, break into their houses, and then I would go in and I would shower, wash my hair, get a bite to eat, turn on the TV, watch the Days of Our Lives, take a little nap, and then feel proud when I made the bed afterwards. And then if I drank their booze in the basement, I'd fill it up with water because I was like that, you know. I'm like that. I'm not the dirty kind of thief. And, like, this is what I was doing. And I thought I was a genius. I thought I was a genius. Like, look how bright, like, I'm not a sheep. Like all those other people having to get a job and a career and all that. I get these suckers to pay for my life. Like, I just thought I was brilliant. And all I needed was, like, a temp and a tambourine, and I was, like, living like Stevie Nicks. And I was a gypsy queen in the crick. Now, when I tell you that I believe that, I believed it. Like, I saw nothing wrong with that. I thought that that was a great idea. And this went on. Didn't go on for too long, but it went on for long enough. And I was so delusional and so sick. I was so sick with booze. The last 5 years of my drinking, I drank like every day. I didn't breathe a sober breath. And anyway, so I'm in the woods this one particular time, and I'm waiting for this gentleman to leave to go to work so I can break in. Now I'm committing felonies, and I'm like, oh, I don't think it's a thing. And I'm waiting for him to leave to get, you know, to go to work so I can break into his house. And I'm waiting behind the hedges, you know, looking and searching. And off to the right-hand side, I see, if you're from Philadelphia, you know about the strip malls, right? So there was all these strip malls. And then on this one side, I saw, like, this little patio. There was, like, five or six people, maybe, like, eight people. And they had these little white styrofoam cups. And I thought, weirdos, what the hell are they doing at 8 in the morning? Because I didn't want to get caught, right? I didn't want to get seen walking up the grassy knoll here, right? Because all these people are, I'm like, what are these weird, they're messing up my mojo. Like, what are they doing here? So while I'm looking, I see one of them spot me, and I'm like, oh my God. You know, like, and the hedges go up, and I'm like, oh my God, he saw me. And little did I know, it was Joe Brown. So you would talk about God working in your life. And he spotted me. I didn't remember him, but he remembered me. So he went walking down that grassy knoll, and it had rained the day before, and it was really sloppy. And I was the bougie kind of homeless. Okay, I don't know if you can pick up on that. But, you know, I was the bougie kind of, I was wearing high heel candies. That is a true story. Remember the candies, ladies? You know, the slip with the wooden heel and all? It was like, I'm coming. Because to really realize that I was homeless was way too painful. There's no way I could have let that sink in. I didn't have the capability, the capacity for that in any way. So anyway, he spotted me, and he came walking down, and I was like, oh, my God, who is this guy? I was like, oh, another one trying to get my number. And he looked at me, and he goes, hey, how you doing? And I'm like, good, good, how are you? And he says, the wisdom of the old-timers, right? He said, listen, he didn't say to me, oh, listen, I remember you. You're the drunk that I found at Sea Lion Bar. He didn't say any of that. He remembered who I was, but he didn't say anything. You know what he said to me? Would you like some coffee and a donut? My ears picked right up. And I was like, and he said, yeah, we're having, you know, there's coffee up there, donuts and some cookies, if you like cookies. And then I saw men, and I was like, a place to stay. Right? Perfect. So, and he bent down, and he pulled me out of the woods. And anytime I hear our pledge of, you know, whenever I am responsible, when anybody at any time reaches out their hand for AA, I am responsible. Joe had many years. Chris talked last night about having multiple years and still being in the trenches. This man had like 40 years when he did this. I didn't even know who he was. He was like this icon up north. He pulled me out, and, you know, my candies went like shlosh, shlosh, shlosh through the grass, right? He looked down, he's like, nice shoes. I was like, thank you. You know, he knew exactly what to say. So I thought, I had no idea where I was going. All I knew was coffee time, donuts, and cookies. And he took me to this meeting, and I thought I was like with these VFW guys, like the grand poopas. I had no idea. No idea where I was going. But that just goes to show you how sick I was. This guy just pulled me out of the woods and I just went with him. So I go into my first AA meeting at the Reality Group on Bustleton Avenue. It was I think it was an 8 o'clock meeting or something. And I walk in and he sits me down and the gentleman next to me, he must have been a sponsee, and he said, "Will you go, go grab her a cup of coffee?" He said, "Oh, okay, So the guy gets up and he goes to the coffee bar and he's grabbed me a cup of coffee, and there was 30, 40 people in the room. It was a big meeting. And as he's coming back, I jumped up and I said, "I like that with two creams and two sugars, and can you pop that in the microwave? I like it boiling hot." And I tell you this story because, I'll tell you why, okay? Because the entitlement of the alcoholic, do you remember being like this and not knowing that you were like this? You were like, "Snappy snap, hurry up, I'm waiting for you to wait on me and I got 3 minutes sober." And aren't you supposed to, where's the AA love? Aren't you supposed to, give me stuff? The entitlement of the alcoholic, right? But we don't know that we're like this. We're delusional. And I always like to tell that story when I speak because I have to remember that when I see that girl coming in the room who's got 90 days, her boobs are all hyped up. She's got the mascara on, and she's wearing the Betty Boop shorts. I'm like, "Hello, come on over here." There I am. Looking for a date. He's like, "Whoop, whoop." I remember. And, that's love and tolerance is our code. Love and tolerance is our code. And the one, and I'll get to this in a minute, but my judgment and my noticer and my analyzer and my pointer I needed to chip away at that over time. Because if we're judging another in here, it's like a death sentence for an alcoholic. We already hate ourselves. Nobody needs to add to our hate. We hate ourselves with such passion. So anyway, I was at this meeting and they got me coffee and I didn't even know where I was. It was my first meeting. I had no idea what they said. All I knew is they were like, "Listen, we're going to go play bocce ball." I was like, "Bocce ball? And then we're going to go for pizza." I was like, "Okay." And I was like, "What are these, who are these people? They're like Good Samaritans or something?" I was so out of it. But there, lo and behold, I went to play bocce ball and I went for pizza. And then all of a sudden they were like, "Listen, you're going to go with Mary." I'm like, "Who's Mary?" And they're like, "Oh, just go with Mary. She'll tell you who she is on the way." Okay. I got in the car and I tell you, I had AA kidnappers. And if you're lucky enough, you're gonna have AA kidnappers too if you stick around. Now let me tell you what AA kidnappers do. They don't tell you anything. No, they just say, just get in the car. Yeah, we're going for ice cream. And 4 days later, you get dropped off. You're like, you've been to 16 meetings. You've been to every pizza parlor on Frankfurt Avenue. You visited Atlantic City and came back. You don't have time to drink. They don't let you even think, right? This is how I got sober. I got struck sober. I never had the thought that day in the woods, I drink too much. Nope. Never had that thought. I never had the thought, I should stop. Nope. Mm-mm. God's grace. That's the only thing, was God's grace. I didn't even want to get sober. But I'll tell you what happened, is that when I started to get a little bit more sober, about 3 weeks into this, Mary was handing me off to Jane, and Jane was handing me off to, Dolly, and Dolly was handing me off to Darlene, and about 3 weeks, they would let me stay maybe 2 or 3 days. And then they said to me, "Lise, listen, you have to find a place to live, honey. We can't just, And I said, I was like, by 3 weeks, you're mildly clear. And I said, you know, I'll go back to my mom's. But I lied to them because I was not going back to my mom's. But I thought, this is what I'll do in my mind. I thought, well, I'll have them drop me off at my mom's, but I'll just go back into the woods. And then I'll just, like, meet them at the meetings. And because I was having a ball, they were paying for everything. I was like, this is great. And my food and, you know, it was great. So as they dropped me off at my mom's, we had to jump this wall. Anyway, long story short, as I was trying to navigate around my mom's house, my mom and dad's house, to go to the path, my mom had opened up the door to take out the trash. And she saw me, and she looked at me, and she said, my God, where have you been? I wasn't allowed to live there at the end. And I looked at her, and she said, come in here. And she sat down. She said, one drink, one, and you got to go. And I was like, okay. I said, I met this guy, Freddy the Fish. And she's like, who? And I said, yeah, he's going to pick me up for meetings. And Freddy the Fish happened to work for my brother. Anyway, long story short, this guy would pick me up at 12 o'clock every day, because I didn't have a job, 12 o'clock every day and take me to a reality group. And she's like, who's Freddy the Fish? Anyway, long story short, he picked me up every single day. And then because I didn't feel safe with women, but by like, I don't know, maybe three months into it, I started to feel safe. And I went to a meeting every day, and this is how I got sober. They just sat on me. That's what they called it, you know, 25, 20, 29 years ago, sitting on you. They just sat on you. They didn't give you time to think. They didn't give you time to drink. They just kept on passing you around until you got, you know, a little bit sober enough to take a sober breath. And and this was like just the biggest miracle of my life. So now I'm getting sober, right? And I'm like, oh my God, this is great. And I'm starting to feel better physically and mentally. I'm starting to like breathe a little better, and I'm going to meetings, and I didn't have a car because my license and all that. But, so they were like, listen, you know, just keep on going to meetings and you get yourself a sponsor and blah. And I was like, yeah. I was like, all right, I'm going to do that. And I just kept going to meetings and kept doing things that they told me to do. And then about 6 or 8 months, you know, I'm sober now, and I got a home group, and I got a job, my job back. I had to call my boss. I got my job back and blah, blah, blah. And then I got my sponsor, and I would call her every time she wasn't home. You know, say, listen, I'm just checking in. But my priority started to be, like, who can I date and who can I meet and what was on sale at Neiman's? And I went back to that, right? And now here I am. I'm like 8, 9 months sober, right? And I got, you know, I joined a gym. I know you're all shocked. And I would, you know, go to the gym like 3 hours a day. I was like, well, you know, 775 push-ups later, and I didn't have a home, but I bought a tanning bed that had 4 bulbs that worked. I'm not kidding you. And ask if I put it in my girlfriend's basement. And then every time after work, I would go and, like, you know, tan like this, you know, just to make sure. I mean, this is how out of my mind I was, make sure I was even, right? And, you know, I would get, like, you know, cowboy boots of the same color. I'd spend my whole check on clothing, and, you know, I had to get dressed up for meetings, and my sponsor was like, Lisa, we need to get, you know, hello, and I was like, yeah, yeah, I know, and then I was getting invited to pig roast and ski trips and, you know, white water rafting and all the activities that AA has to offer, and I'm on fire for the fellowship. And you know that, you know, I'm sleeping around. I mean, that's just a given, right? First, I don't know, 6 months, I'm like, I called my sponsor one. I'm like, you know, I saw this one guy, and then this other guy was there, and she's like, Lisa, like, you need to do the steps. Like, you're just exactly the way you were without the booze. And I'm like, well, that's good. Like, I thought that was positive. She's like, no, darling. But there was no judgment against me. So I kept on going to these different things, and finally I went to a place called the South Philly Group, and I walked into the room. I had about almost a year sober, and there he was. You know who he is, right? And there was an open seat next to him, and I thought, God made that happen. Remember when you used to say that? Oh, it had to be exactly because God, there was an open seat. God would have never have done that. So I sat right next to him, and he said, you know, he's like, hey, you know, what step are you on? And I wasn't doing steps. I was like, oh, what step are you on? He's like, oh, I'm on step 4. I'm like, well, I'm on step 3. I just finished step 3, and I'm going to be on step 4. He's like, oh, that's wonderful. And I got in the car with Kathy that night, and I said, come on, Kathy, we got to hurry up and do the steps. She's like, what's the big rush now? Like, all of a sudden, you want to do the steps? And I got to tell you that God, in his infinite mercy, used my character defects and my nonsense to his benefit to help me stay sober. Thank God is right. Because I didn't know any different. So when you see newcomers under a year and they're bending over in front of the, you know. Or they're doing the Miss America wave when they come into the meetings. That was me. That was me. I didn't know any better. So they kept on telling me that I had to do my steps, had to do my steps. So finally, okay, because of this guy and my lust for him, I wanted to do my steps. So I started doing my steps. But the only thing was that I was in a rush because he was already on his 4th, and I had to catch up. So I was like, all right, what do they want me to do again? I mean, when I tell you that my brain was saturated with alcohol, now, the whole time that I'm in AA, these women are telling me right to my face what I need to do. They're like, Lisa, and they're telling me the truth about alcoholism. They're telling me the truth about the fatal nature of my illness, that I'm going to die. If I don't, you know, they're not lying to me, but what's happening is I have this filter, right? This alcoholic filter that I only hear what I want to hear. This delusional state that has not left me yet. So I was like, yeah. Have you ever met the polite alcoholic? Okay, let me explain the polite alcoholic. They listen intently. Yes, you're so right. And they go out and do whatever the hell they want. That was me. Oh, we got a few polite alcoholics over there, right? That was me. Very polite. I was very polite. And then I thought, whack job. In my mind. Because I could not really put it together. So I kept doing this, and I kept doing this. And I did my steps, and I did my 4-step, and I was like, you know, oh, you know, where was I wrong? And then I thought, I really wasn't wrong there, but they want me to do it, so I'll write it down. And, you know, and I did my steps enough to get by because there was some kind of freedom that happened. After I did my 5th, I was like, wow, I feel better. I felt a little better about myself. And then I did my 9th step, and I made some hard amends that I never thought that I would make. And that made me feel about 2 inches taller. So that first set of steps was that first set of steps is like it linked me in. Because now I feel a part of. Okay, I don't know that it's really not the best step work, but it links me in and it makes me feel a part of the community. So now things are starting to get better for me. Now I'm 2.5, 3 years sober, 4 years sober. Now things are really getting better, and I'm making more money, and I'm doing the deal, and I'm sponsoring women, and all of a sudden, like, you know, I start not feeling good again. Has anybody thought, right? You know, that hole in your soul starts opening up, and you start thinking, what the hell's the matter with me? What the hell is going on with me? Because when we first come into Alcoholics Anonymous and the drinking stops, we think, oh, thank God that crap is over with. Now I can get on busy, get on to live, right? Uh-huh. There's a line in our book that says, aren't we under the illusion and the delusion that we can rest happiness and satisfaction in this life if we only manage it well? Should have had that tattooed right here, because that was the line that I was convinced. Aren't we under the illusion and delusion? It doesn't say, aren't we in denial? I was delusional to think that if I could just get it all right, I'm good. I'm golden. So I had like 4 years sober, and that hole started to open up in my heart again. So what do we do? You know, when the hole starts, we get married. I mean, of course we do. I know I did. And I was like, I got to get married. That's going to cure it. So the first poor bastard that I got a hold of, we went down the aisle, and I remember my sponsor, Kathy, at the time, as I was walking down the aisle with my father, and I had a beautiful wedding, gorgeous wedding, right? As I was walking down the aisle, she stuck her head out, and she was like, good luck. And I remember with my dad's arm thinking, was that like good luck, or was that like good luck? Like, while I was going up to say my vows, I swear that's a true story. I couldn't figure that out, but I learned later. I had to make an amends to him. But it was all his fault. Right? It was all his fault. You know, what I did was I shifted. See, alcoholism, okay, is a sickness. It is a mental twist. This is, our mental health is compromised. And we think that we know what we're doing all the time. And the ego is the killer. Genevieve talked about it today, about that. Says it in your own words. Convinces you of your own nonsense. We can justify absolutely anything. And then swear it on a Bible, put us under a lie detector test, and we're flying and we're passing. That's alcoholism. It manifests in our minds and in our bodies, not in bottles. If it was in bottles, my brother Jimmy, he's not an alcoholic, he's one bourbon with his steak, and I'm still like 20-odd years later, I'm saying, how does he do that? I've never had that experience. Anyway, long story short, now I'm married, and that's not working. That's not filling. Now, in the book, they call this sprees. They talk about sprees. And that we have to be very careful. We have to start being honest with our sponsors. Right? So now the marriage isn't working out, right? Now it's giving me nothing but ag. I just want him out. I'm like, ugh, God. Now, you know, I'm done with that. We're not real patient people, by the way. And I had a great idea. Right? And that idea was, you know what? I need money. I need success. I'm going to get really ambitious and I did. I thought, okay, I'm going to open up my own jewelry store in Julesboro, because I was a gemologist for many years, but I'm going to open up my own store. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to make my own money. I'm going to blah, 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 blah. And guess what? It happened. I did it. You know what's almost worse for an alcoholic than drinking and all that nonsense is getting sober and being successful and not having a God. Oh, that's lethal. Now, I didn't know I didn't have a God, but I'm going to get to that in a minute. So there I am, now making a lot of money. I'm buying a house in Jersey. I'm getting a house down the shore. I'm doing this. I'm getting the carpets, you know, the custom-made cabinets, the thing, my hair done, the whole nine. I'm wearing, you know, clothes with only designer things, and I'm getting real bougie now. And I'm about 6 or 7 years sober at this time, and I'm sponsoring 6 or 7 women. I'm telling them how to live their life, telling them who to sleep with, giving them financial advice, telling them about insurance policies. That's how I was sponsoring. Because I had a sponsor, but I really, you know, I was talking to her, but I wasn't talking about anything that was really bothering me, because now, like, I got something to lose. Like, I thought people were looking up to me. Had a reputation to uphold. In the loony bin. We're all in paper slippers here. All of us. You know, I was telling my brother Jimmy, you know, Jimmy, he's a normie, right? And I was telling him about, you know, oh, yeah, they asked me to come down to Georgia and blah, blah, blah. And you know, and I remember one time he's like, yeah, remember that time that you told me that you were going to a meeting? And that guy Joe who he was living under a bridge for like 15 years, and you were so happy to go hear his story. And I remember saying, like, and you're going to take advice from this guy? Like, we're all in paper slippers here. And we think that we're not. We can convince ourselves that we're either above or below. But God, in his graciousness, if you're lucky enough to stay sober, will crush that ego right out of you with circumstances and people. And if you're lucky enough to stay sober through that, because that's a hard one. That's a hard fall. So now I have the money, and I'm, you know, they're opening up the car dealership, and I'm driving out my sexy new car, and, you know, I'm trying to make things work with my husband that was not going well. And I have my business, and I have this, and I have that, and I'm sponsoring girls, and I'm doing the thing, and I'm ba 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 ba. And one day I walk into this meeting. It was called Keep It Simple, Stupid. I should have known right there. And a woman named Sally Blatherworth, God rest her soul, she was my sponsor for the next 15 years, but I didn't know that. And she was sharing for her 25 years. And something clicked. I heard something with her, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to go out and talk to her after she's done. So I went out and I talked to her, and I said, hey, Sally, my name is Lisa, blah, blah, blah. And this is how I introduced myself. I said, what I'm about to tell you could ruin my reputation. Now, I'm 8 years sober. She goes, stop right there. She goes, let me tell you something, Lisa. I've seen you around. And I thought, I'm like known. Seeing you around. Yeah, I call you like the busy. I go, the busy? What are you talking about, the busy? She goes, oh, you're real busy. Busy with your life. Busy, 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 busy. Busy with your work. Busy with your life. Busy with your husband. Now you're thinking about going back to school. So you keep yourself busy from 6 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock at night. And you're busy sponsoring. Busy taking people up. And busy doing this and busy doing that. And you can't sit in a room with yourself for 5 minutes. You're so busy. And she said, you know, any day now, you're going to drink. And I was so insulted. I said, you know, I have 8 years sober. She said, I don't care what you got. But something clicked. Something clicked. I was like, she's got it. Like, she knows. She wasn't psychic. And she said, if you want to get better, be at my house tomorrow at 9:30 at Lake Drive, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, okay. And I went home, and usually I wouldn't show up to something like that, right? And I thought, you know, there's something's got to give. Because about 6 months prior to that, in my fancy new car that I got, I was driving over the Benjamin Franklin Bridge. And in the therapeutic community, you'll hear something called suicidal ideations. Right? So I'm driving my fancy new car and I'm thinking to myself, how can I get the airbag out of this car? If I just go fast enough. And then I would think, why the hell am I thinking like that? What the hell's the matter with me? Because if you're an alcoholic, you don't even know the amount of pain you're in when you're living like that. See, Lisa just goes for like good enough. I don't go for happy or great. I don't. That doesn't even cross my mind. So it's like always having a stone in your shoe. You just get used to it. You like maneuver your foot around the. You just get used to it. But I was having these thoughts, and then like maybe 2 months later, I would have. You know, I didn't want to drink, but I wanted to die. I started to want to die. Out of nowhere, I start to want to die. Right? I'm 8 years sober, and I think to myself, you know, 60 Valium, I wonder if that'll do the trick. And then I think to myself, what the hell is going on with me? But I don't tell anybody. I'm not sharing that with anyone. I'm not sharing the language of the heart. I'm not sharing what's really going on because I'm too afraid of myself. I am too afraid that if I open up that box, it's never, ever going to close again. So when I met Sally, God's divine intervention was the exact moment that I needed to meet her. And I went over to her house. I walked into her living in her kitchen, and she said, go get the mirror in the bathroom. And I went in and got this little makeup mirror, and she said, sit it down here on the kitchen table. And she sat down with me, and she said, look in the mirror. And I looked in the mirror, and she said, there's your problem. I was like, oh, like gurus do this, or like, what? Hello. She said, you know, you've been sober for 8 years, right? I was like, yeah. She goes, you no longer have a drinking problem. You don't have a drinking problem. You got an ism. It's alcoholism, not wasm. How many times did you hear that? And I thought, oh my God. She, you know, like they're killing me with these refrigerator magnet sayings. Oh my God, please stop. Please stop trying to puzzle me with this crap. Alcoholism, not wasm. I was like, oh my God, please. But that was the truth. We have alcoholism, not wasm. My alcoholism started the moment I put down the drink. It started. I didn't know this. I had no idea. And it was painful. It's painful to live dry without a God. Most people pick up. If it wasn't for Sally, I would have definitely drank. She said to me, be over at my house every Tuesday night. 6:30 to 7:30 is your slot. I'm going to go through the book. It's going to take 4 months. You get one dismissal, like one time that you can say you're not going to be there. And don't answer me now. Think about it for 48 hours. Come back to me either with a commitment or without a commitment, but please don't waste my time because there's 10 women behind you that are dying. I remember leaving thinking, man, she's a hard ass. Jesus! And she was like 4'7", like she had a perm. She looked like a librarian until you talked to her. I was like, oh my God. She is rough. Thank God. Thank God how rough she was. We went through the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous again. Now, up north, they do it a little different. When I was getting sober, we go through the 12 and 12 first, and then the big book. That's how it was done with me. I'm going to share what I was told to read every single night while I was going through the book with her for 4 months. Just one paragraph. Yet these instincts, so necessary for our existence, often far exceed the proper functions, and powerfully, blindly, and many times subtly, they drive us, they dominate us, and they insist upon ruling our lives. Our desires for sex, for material and emotional security, and for an important place in society often tyrannize us. One thus is out of joint, man's natural desires or desires cause him great trouble, practically all the trouble there is. And no human, however good, is exempt from these troubles, and nearly every serious emotional problem can be seen as misdirected instinct. And when that happens, our great natural asset, the instincts, have turned into physical and mental liabilities. She said, I want you to read that paragraph. It's the second paragraph in step four. And I want you to read it because your instincts have gone astray, Lisa. See, you think anything from the outside is going to fill that hole. And what's happening, Lisa, is the more you get, the wider the hole gets. And the more that you acquire and the more success and the more money and the more men and the more this and more that, it gets wider and wider until the door, because you can't take it anymore. You can't take what the ego is doing. The alcoholic ego, it's like mold. No matter what you do, it always grows back. Incrementally and slowly, even when you're on top of your game, it grows back. It never lets up. God is the only elixir. God is the only way out of this thing. I came from a Catholic background that hurt me. My mother was like devoutly religious. And that's a whole nother story. But it was not good for me, with me and God. So I had to find my higher power. I had to rely on my higher power. Sally said to me, Lisa, listen, I know that you have faith. You have 8 years sober. You have faith. You've made it this far. There's some kind of connection that you have acquired. You have that. She said, let me just tell you the difference between faith and trust. She said, have you ever been to the circus? And I said, yeah, I've been to the circus. She goes, you ever see that the guy on the wire, right, with that pole thing? And he walks across the pole with those silly slippers on. And you're in the audience, and you're like looking like, oh, my God, I hope he doesn't slip and fall. And every once in a while he does this, and the whole audience goes, ah. And like, oh, my God, is he going to make it? Oh, my God, right? But you have some type of faith. You have some faith. Then he's going to make it to the other side because you know that he's done it 300 times. She's now trust. Trust is getting out of the audience, going down, going, walking up that ladder and jumping on his shoulders. I was like, oh, well, I don't know about that. See, you got to have a little skin in the game when it comes to trust. Trust is skin in the game. When you're walking and you have absolutely no idea what's going to happen, that you just have to believe and you're scared to death and you do it anyway. And you have courage to make it through. And when your knees are wobbling and shaking and you make it anyway, and you raise your hand at 10, 12, 15 years sober and say, I'm not doing so good today. Because alcoholism has no idea about time. It's like diabetes knows about time or cancer knows about that. Alcoholism is an illness like every other illness. It is out to kill its host. It has no time frame reference. You know, we got to be there for the newcomers, but for the old timers too. For that 8 to 15 year. Oh, that's a time, boy. Because our ego's powerful at that time. because we think we know something. And then your ego gets crushed, and then you're in so much pain because you find out you don't know nothing. And you have to stay sober through that pain because divorces happen. And you on your high horse, you get knocked down. You gotta stay sober through that. Now, this whole time that I've been talking to you tonight, I haven't been telling you that through all this, at 4 years sober, my brother Danny, I found him dead. Right? And I wasn't going to feel that. You know, he went out one night, he got so wasted that he threw up and regurgitated on his own, and he didn't survive that. And we were living together at the time, and like that, it felt like somebody unzipped my body, opened it up, took out my organs, stomped on them, put them back in, zipped me up and said, go about your way. Like I was not gonna feel that. It was way too painful. I could not handle that. And then at 6 years sober, my father passed away. I was like, like I just would not allow myself to feel. 9 years sober, my other brother passed away from alcoholism, so my family got hit twice. And then I was divorced. And then I lost my sponsor, and then my cat of 18 years. Like all the frame, like of 10 years. But I'm going to tell you what the AA kidnappers turned into be. See, my AA kidnappers turned into be my AA angels, because every time that happened to me, especially the first one when my brother Danny died, I was 4 years sober. I was in a ball, naked in my shower, and I could not get up. I couldn't get up. I couldn't. And they came in with crock pots full of meatballs and beef stew and vegetable soup and rolls. I was like, what the f***? What are you doing here? They're like, come on! Get her up. Get her shower. Come on, get her dressed. Taking her to a meeting. I'm like, I'm not going anywhere. They're like, oh, we know. In the car I went. Here I am in the car. They're like, oh, so did you hear about Joni? Yeah, and they just went, they didn't let me. See, self-pity, Chris talked about it. Oh, my God, self-pity. Self-pity is the first, I don't know why that, in the big book, and this is the only thing I want to say, this is going to be a little radical here, but you know how they say that resentment is the number one offender? For me, it's self-pity.
That's right.
Number one offender. Because nobody, and listen, who's going to say anything about my self-pity when my brothers and my dad and everybody's dying on me? I got reason. I got a legit, this is how, I can't even tell you how sick I am, or was, I could be. I might stay, you might see me 10 years from now being like, oh, remember when I gave that talk? I thought I had it, I knew what I was doing. We go through these stages where we think we know what we're doing, right? So, I remember I had, I don't know, like 8 or 9 years sober, and I remember someone saying to me, and I was like, don't you, like I used my brother's grief. I used my brother's grief to get things and for you to feel sorry for me and like this way, you know. I don't know if anybody else can relate to that, but that's what my manipulation and stuff that comes back. If I'm not on my illness all the time, how do you stay on top of your illness? God, 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 God. It's the only way. It's the only way for me. Because I'm hardwired to be something else. So if I don't have a God of my understanding to keep on shining me and helping me, I'm not going to make it. So if anybody's in here and you have like 10 months sober or 2 years sober or 3 years sober and you're walking around, you're like, something ain't right, something, you're in the right spot. Welcome. Welcome home. You don't have to drink because you're not feeling good. You don't have to drink because you know, something isn't going right in your life. Just keep coming back and keep raising your hand and keep complaining and just keep coming back. I did everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. And by God's grace, I stayed sober, not because of me, but because of you people. You people. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe my sanity to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, what a gift. A kid like me was living in the woods, breaking into people's houses, and I get a call from Amy. She's like, would you like to come? And I'm like, they don't even know who I am. Okay, I'll go there. What a gift. I mean, to share in your craziness with Mike running around in that dress. I mean, I can't even tell you how much I love that. I can't even tell you how much I love crazy. I'm so attracted to it. I mean, when Billy was talking about, you know, his family was like an episode of Cops, and the man was yelling at the woman, and the baby was dressed in nighttime, daytime clothes. I was like, oh my God, I was in nighttime, daytime clothes until I was like 27. I mean, that's just how I grew up. And to have a place like this to come to share my heart, like Anna Marie said, the language of the heart. That we can not know each other and hug. It is the greatest gift that has been given to me. The greatest thing. I can't thank you enough for allowing me to be here. Thank you. That's all I have. My name's Lisa Lowen. I'm an alcoholic.